The Man Talks are a series of interviews with personalities in the domain of human-computer interaction who have ideas deserving a closer look. My name is Johannes van der Meulen, and today we are having Chris Johnson of the Glasgow Accident Analysis Group. Chris's group aim is to better understand the failure of complex systems, including emergency response and contingency analysis. He's a professor of computing science at the University of Glasgow and works on reporting near-miss incidents within safety management systems. He's held awards from NASA, US Air Force, as well as from the European Commission and UK government. Most recently, he's been involved in a project to develop guidance material for contingency planning against threats, including terrorism, in European air traffic management. Welcome, Chris, today.
Hi.
I'd like to first ask you to introduce the topic a little bit by saying what your current interest is in accident investigation and what is your current fascination, I should say, with the topic.
I think that accidents are lessons, if you like. They provide us with opportunities to learn from failures. And very often, I mean, in most industries, in the Western world in particular, they are rare events. And it's really important to learn when things go wrong and to transfer the lessons to make sure as many people as possible know about the previous failures. Otherwise, the argument goes that we're destined to repeat them. And you see this quite often, where accidents in one country are repeated sometimes later in another country because the information wasn't exchanged promptly. And there have been initiatives to support this, for example, to encourage different European member states to record information and then provide it to other member states. But it's still something that we're not particularly good at. And I think the other point I would make is that another reason for working in this area is the disparity. If you think about the number of organizations and research groups and government committees and so on that are devoted to the design of new systems, there's only a very small proportion of those are in any way interested in learning, if you like, from failures. Success is always more attractive to learn from than failure. And I suppose part of my mission is to kind of redress that balance a bit.
The role of human-computer interaction or human factors engineering and all this, that is risk assessment, accident investigation, is important, I assume, but it's not all about just about human factors, is it?
It's kind of interesting the way that you put the question, because for many years, it would have been the opposite way around. People would have said that risk assessment was about technical systems and that human behavior was not something that we could regulate for and something that was very difficult to deal with in the design of safety critical systems. And it's still the case that many agencies respond to accidents by trying to remove people entirely from the system. But that's doomed to failure in many ways, because you might remove the operator by designing automated control systems, but then you've still got somebody to maintain the system. Or if it's a computer-based control system, then increasingly you have to have programmers who are willing to tailor the system, provide the data, provide the programming, and so on. So at some point, humans always enter into the question. So then it becomes a question of what proportion, if you like, of accidents are due to human error? And that's a difficult question to answer. In recent times, there's been a trend of human factors people and human computer interface people who have made quite ludicrous claims about the percentages of accidents devoted to or caused by human error. People say 80%, 90% of accidents, and those kind of figures rely upon this previous line of analysis that I described, where, you know, if you keep going back, then if it's not the operator, then there might have been a management decision, or it might have been a maintenance issue, and at some point in this tracing back the causes of failure, you come across a human being, and so therefore that, you know, 90% of accidents are due to humans. And it's kind of a fallacious argument, if you like, and you wonder why it's not 100%. What are the remaining 10% caused by if they're not caused by people? So in recent work with Michael Holloway at NASA, we've been trying to develop a method for identifying the proportion of accidents that are caused by humans.
Primarily caused by humans.
Yeah, and what's important about that is to agree on processes for making that kind of analysis so that people can disagree about the percentages that we arrive at, but the method is clear so people understand that if they wanted to repeat the study, they could replicate our results. And we've used this in aviation accidents, maritime accidents. Most recently, we've been going back into the very early days of aviation to ask questions whether the causes of accidents have changed over, say, 50 years. And it's interesting because there's been an argument that human error is increasingly important in the causes of accidents. But actually, we find very little change. The percentages of direct pilot-induced accidents don't seem to have changed much over the period of modern commercial aviation, possibly with the exception of the last 6 months. We've seen, in particular, the National Transportation Safety Board in the last 6 months to a year almost focus, if you like, exclusively on the role of pilot error. And I think there's two possible explanations. One is that there's been a change in recruitment policy of the pilots in the United States, and suddenly we have underprepared crews. And I don't think that that's a plausible explanation. Another explanation might be to do with the investigatory processes that are used, and perhaps people are focusing more on crew factors. And that's what makes this area so interesting and also so difficult to work in. A lot of the time, we're not dealing with the prima facie, the truth of what happened in an accident. We're looking at what investigators identify as being significant from previous failures. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing goes on in your house if somebody burns the food. What caused it? And, you know, you could say it was a distraction, or you could say it was the chef. Or there's often very different, great differences of opinion on what causes any adverse event, even in your own house.
What you just said, how would that apply to degraded modes, which is another line of investigation for you? Degraded modes of operation, is that is primarily human factors, or is that mostly a technical factor, or again, is it both?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, to explain, degraded modes is a term that we use to refer to systems which aren't operating to what would be called their desired capacity or their desired architecture. In other words, we're assuming that there's been a failure in maintenance or a failure in the design of a component. And again, I come back to things that we face in our everyday lives. You know, if we wake up in the morning and we find that the light on our bicycle isn't working, you know, we might replace the batteries, and if the case is cracked, we might use sellotape and so on. So we find lots of kind of workarounds to deal with the systems that we operate. And in most cases, those workarounds are successful and they don't have any consequences. But every so often, they can have devastating results. Just in a domestic context, an example of a coping strategy would be if you don't have a ladder, you balance one chair on top of a table, and then you stand on that chair to try and change a light bulb. And if you get away with it and you change the light bulb, everything looks successful. But if the chair falls off the table and you break your leg and you arrive in the hospital and you tell them what you did, then you're going to look like you've taken a really stupid risk.
Can you give an example of this in the air or rail transport?
If you look back, there's been a precursor or some warning of what might happen, and you reflect upon why those warnings were ignored. The examples that I've worked most on involve air traffic management, and you have instances there where controllers will work around maintenance failures in their equipment. They'll work with only partial aspects of the radar system working. They will try and cope when the telecommunications systems begin to fail. What's interesting is that in modern system design, we have fallback systems. So we have more than one way of doing things. So there might be three communication systems available to a controller. And if the first one doesn't work, then they can go and use the second system. And why that's problematic is that very often these fallback systems are unfamiliar, or they're slightly harder to use than the primary system. You know, there is a reason why these fallback systems are held in reserve. Under high workload, these fallback systems, with their extra complexity, if you like, often push people over the edge. So suddenly we see accidents that occur because of a combination of equipment failure, of poor weather, of high operating loads. And so coming back to the original question that you asked a while ago, it's often human error is one part of these more complex system failures, which include maintenance issues or the degraded modes that we've been talking about. To identify or focus in on any one aspect is often to lose the complexity that exists in the failures that we see.
As an excellent investigator, how do you feel about flying?
It varies. I spend a lot of my time reading accident reports or talking to the families of people who have been involved in accidents. And I think anybody with any kind of imagination would be slightly disturbed by some of those experiences. But at the same time, balance against that, I spend a lot of time with the engineers, the technicians and the staff that operate at all levels in the aviation industry. And so I find that reassuring. But also I think if you work in this industry, you have to be able to disconnect your private life from your professional life. So there have been times when I've been sitting at airports in thunder and lightning while they've refueled the aircraft, knowing that this is a violation of ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, rules, and that the company and the airport should instantly cease what they're doing. But deep within me is a desire to get home on time. And I spent some time working on the transcripts of survivors from the World Trade Center. And the scale of that incident I found most difficult to deal with. The kind of testimony that came out of it and the small differences that helped some people to survive while other people died. It's not just a technical issue. I think it changes your attitude to life and your family and your friends.
Yes. But are people very bad at assessing risk in general? I mean, if you stay in that plane, although you are statistically well-versed and sophisticated, I assume you still decide to stay in there. Isn't that a human characteristic to kind of take risks they shouldn't take?
Well, there's one line of thought, which is that the whole concept of risk was designed by engineers to bully and terrorize the public. And it's a thing which only engineers use, and usually it's to try and convince you of something that you wouldn't want to do anyway. So it's interesting, you know, so much of society is based around this idea of risk assessment and risk mitigation. And I know that there are biases in the way that people deal with risk, and so kind of to blame the public and say, oh, the public don't understand risk, is actually to kind of presuppose that basing society around risk is a good thing anyway. I mean, risk is and risk assessment techniques are merely a way of formalizing things which should be considered during decision-making. And
decision-making about the design of systems.
Yeah. And so to say that people don't understand risk assessment and therefore don't really understand how to make safety related decisions is to kind of put the baby out with the bathwater, you know. What we should be doing is saying, well, risk assessment doesn't really model accurately how the public feel about this problem, so the problem is with risk assessment, not with the public. Any decision maker that relies upon risk assessment and can't communicate that risk assessment to the public shouldn't really be doing that job.
You just talked about risk mitigation. Is it the question of spending more money on risk mitigation? Or what are your overall recommendations to systems designers about managing risk? You just said communicating is an important aspect as well. What methods or techniques would you propose to an engineer designing, say, a rail traffic management system in order to assess the risk? I mean, would you recommend doing a risk assessment at all? And how much money should be spent on doing the risk assessment? Is it just a question of throwing a lot of money at it and then everything will be okay?
Risk assessment is just a tool to inform decision making, and it's not an end in itself. So really, the fact that you've done a risk assessment doesn't prove anything. Investment that you put into risk assessment depends upon the nature of the system, the nature of the consequences, and the kind of changes that you might want to make to that system if you believe there was a possibility for that system to go wrong. By and large, that's how the standards are organized, and national governments create regulators, and regulators try and enforce the standards, and risk assessment is one way of satisfying the regulators. And really, the question about how much money you should spend depends on how much your regulator wants you to spend. In a brutal commercial sense, if you spend a penny more than your regulator requires, then that's a penny that you've wasted. Of course, the public might not view it that way if you have an accident, but that's the answer.
You focus very much on complex and critical systems where many lives or lots of money are at risk, are at stake at the same time with one incident. Cars are a notorious killer, and driving a car, I've heard statistics saying that when you look at, if you take into account takeoff and landing of planes, that it's more safe to fly a plane starting at distances of 20 kilometers than to drive a car, in view of the fact that takeoff and landing is the most dangerous part, as we found out from recent accidents the last few weeks. So shouldn't more money be spent or more risk assessment techniques be applied to the car industry than to rail and air industries?
Car industries have been pioneers of risk assessment. It's kind of, people look at cars and they think, well, you know, they haven't changed much in 50 years, so it's not really a safety critical system in the same sense as an aircraft, but that's to ignore what the car companies are doing. So there are standards to introduce computer control, the same kind of fly-by-wire technology in drive-by-wire cars, and the companies that are involved in those developments are conducting risk assessment in extreme detail about the computer systems that will effectively drive your cars for you. The idea of risk assessment not applying in cars is I think a wrong one. They have developed techniques for risk assessment. Now, whether the balance of investment is correct between aviation and cars, people try to characterize that in terms of the risk assessments that I've mentioned overall between industries. So there is an argument that people are more concerned about involuntary risks than they are about voluntary risks. In other words, if you're traveling around the town, you have some choice or discretion about whether you cycle, you walk, you use public transport, or you use the car. And so people in some sense are less concerned about the risks of those particular methods of transport. Whereas if you're trying to get from Brussels to Budapest or to New York, in the modern world, I think flying is the only possibility. And so therefore, people are much more concerned. They have less opportunity to choose alternatives. And so there is a public expectation that the standards of risk assessment and of of safety critical development are higher in that case than they are where you have alternates.
And I presume we should also take into account the road infrastructure, which is as important a component in the whole car travel business as the car itself, isn't it?
Yeah, we've worked in the past on projects in road layout, so road designers take into account the sharpness of the angle of every turn onto your major motorway system. Even a few degrees will make a difference in terms of the total number of accidents that you'll have on that piece of road. I think what's interesting, though, is in particular areas of accident investigation, the road system is very primitive. So if you take, for example, I mentioned before that software is increasingly used in cars. And a good example would be in braking systems and in engine management systems. And if you ask how many people have died on European roads through software errors in these systems, the answer is almost zero. And the reason for that is not because we have complete confidence in the systems that are deployed, but because the road traffic investigators, the police that arrive on the scene of accidents, when they fill out the forms, they're usually deciding between driver error or road conditions or maintenance of the vehicle. There's almost no way for these people to suggest or even think of software as a possible cause in that road traffic accident. Whereas if you contrast this with aviation, increasingly investigators are becoming concerned that software might be a cause in aviation accidents. And so we have quite a lot of data about software-related aviation accidents. But I think it'll be many, many years before we really have that same quality of information about road traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And then you ask, well, why that might be? And I think it's because, as I say, people view the risks of road transport and technical innovation in road transport as completely different from those involved in aviation.
Yeah, because it's discretionary. They can choose what transportation vehicle to choose, and then
and also the consequences of any incident in road traffic, seen as many, many separate incidents with a small consequence each, whereas in aviation, one large incident will be infrequent, but the consequences are enormous.
Yes. In risk assessment and complex systems, there exists the concept of a safety case. It's an interesting concept. What is a safety case?
A safety case is usually constructed to explain why a system is acceptable. In other words, why any risks posed by the system are as low as reasonably practicable or can at least be compared to previous systems. The use of terms in the previous sentence reflects international differences across Europe. In some countries in Europe, they use this approach of comparing risks so that the new system is at least as good as the old system, whereas in other European countries and in the other European industries, they use this as low as reasonably practicable. In either case, what you're basically doing is to construct an argument to show that your system meets these criteria. Like any argument, you bring evidence to support the claims that you make. So if you say that you've reduced the risks as low as reasonably practicable, you then have to bring evidence that you've used, for instance, appropriate risk assessment techniques, and that any risks that you've identified, or in particular hazards that you've identified, have been mitigated by appropriate actions and so on. So it's really a document that explains to people why the system should be allowed to operate.
So required by the regulator, in most cases, I assume. Can you give me a few examples of common risk assessment methods?
There are lots of risk assessment techniques, fault tree analysis, failure modes, effects and criticality analysis, HAZOPS, and so on. So many different techniques coming from many different industries. They often have well-known strengths and weaknesses. So with fault trees, sometimes it can be difficult to represent the influence of human error. With failure modes and effects analysis, it can sometimes be difficult to represent complex domino effects or effect of effects of effects.
Yes.
And this also reflects this point I made at the start of the talk or the discussion here, which is really that this is an open area. It's not an area of complete understanding. We in many cases we don't understand how to develop safety critical systems, and there's still a continuing search for better methods and better techniques for risk assessment. I'll give you two specific illustrations. One is human error. So what is the probability of somebody seeing a display and acting within a particular time? And you can derive figures for that through observation, through running experiments with a particular interface, you know, thousands of runs and so on. But then there are problems because the way that people interact is often determined by what are called performance shaping factors. So if you take that same person and you give them alcohol, or they take drugs, either for medical reasons or for recreational reasons, or their marriage starts to break up, then the probabilities that you derived for the initial response to a display suddenly change radically, and you end up having huge assumptions. So this is the kind of error rate that we'd have for this particular display, assuming that the operator isn't drunk, hasn't taken drugs, isn't going through a divorce, hasn't lost their dog. So that's the first area where we don't really understand how to do fully how to do risk assessment with human operators. And the second area is software. And so the traditionally with risk assessment, we look at how likely a component might be to fail, or something like a light bulb. And you know, if you turn the light on maybe 1,000 times, then you maybe get a failure on that 1,001st time. And so with devices, hardware devices, you can work out failure rates through observations, and it's almost like a random process. If you run 10 light bulbs or 1,000 light bulbs, you begin to get a fairly good idea of the areas in which those light bulbs will fail, just how long that you can operate them before you're starting to get them to burn out. Now, if we take software, software is deterministic. So if we run a series of instructions in the computer once and it fails, if we run that same set of instructions again, it will fail, and a third time it will fail. In other words, it'll always fail in the same way. So we can't use this kind of element of randomness to say, you know, we'd have one light bulb failure in a thousand hours of use, for example. If we know that there's a bug in a piece of code, then we have to fix it. It's a known failure. If it operates, if we ever operate that sequence of instructions, it will fail. So we can't use stochastic, statistical, probabilistic techniques with software. So what we've just done there is describe two major problems with risk assessment: human error and software failure. If we think of all the safety critical systems that rely upon humans or software in them, you'll begin to see the problems for using risk assessment, that for any complex system, in most applications that we're dealing with, risk assessment techniques are useful, but they're not technically capable at the moment of dealing with the vast majority of the really difficult systems that we have to design.
And you should know, because you've been dealing with risk assessment for a very, very long time. Close off, two questions. First one is, where is your research taking you? Where do you hope your research will be taking you in the coming few years? And second question is, where can we, as amateurs in risk assessment, pick up what are, for example, the best book you've read in the last few years that is slightly vulgarizing, so brings it to a larger audience? Those are two questions.
I think, well, first of all, I'd say that when I first started working in accident analysis, I had this view that if I studied accidents for enough time, I would eventually know how to design safety critical systems better. But unfortunately, after 15 years of working in this area, I still don't feel I understand why accidents happen. And I haven't got to the design stage yet. I understand a bit about why failures occur. But part of the problem, as I mentioned before, is that the complexity of the systems keeps increasing. So instead, what I've tried to do is to try and think of what are the worst possible accidents that can happen. And increasingly, I'm working in areas called contingency planning, asking questions about how vulnerable are we as a society. So in the last decade, large areas of Europe have lost all their electrical power because of a very small number of incidents of particular failures in substations. And the more that we interconnect our systems, then the more vulnerable a society we're becoming. Another example would be in air traffic management. We can have delays in one airport propagating out and causing delays in entirely different areas of Europe. And the plans in both energy generation and in air traffic management are to increase the integration throughout Europe. And that's great because it can generate all sorts of new potential of storing capacity and of transferring energy and of synchronizing flights. But it's also bad because we create the opportunities for more complex, longer lasting failures of the sort that my work examines. So I'm interested in contingency, which is an escalation of accidents, and which also includes terrorist action, where we're dealing with the agency, if you like, of people trying to encourage vulnerabilities in our systems. And there's a phrase that's very popular in the literature at the moment called resilience, which I find a bit irritating, because the kind of systems I'm looking at include things like hospitals. And probably the only way that you can create a resilient hospital is by keeping the patients out. So I think society will be vulnerable, and we need to prepare. As far as books go, it's a difficult question to answer. I would recommend that people actually read accident reports. If you go onto the web and you look at, in the States, for example, www.ntsb.gov,
That's National Transportation Safety Board.
You can read first-hand accounts of major failures in aviation, in roads, in maritime industry, and so on. Similarly, with every European nation, there's usually an archive of accident reports, and they're much more important than reading the work of academics in this area. And if you work in a safety-related industry, you know, this should be a key part of your professional development. And sadly, too often I sit in meetings where it's clear that engineers have very little engagement with past failures. They're so focused on future success.
Mm-hmm. I should also mention, if you Google Chris Johnson, on your website, there's a 1,000 page manuscript, Failure and Safety Critical Systems, a Handbook of Incident Reporting, which is a work in progress. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it's a work under review. I mean, I've been working on it for about 5 years, and the changes haven't been as great as they should have been. But
thank you very much, Chris, for your time, and we wish you a lot of success. Of course we do, because we want to lead safe lives.
Well, I'd rather be out of business than too busy in the accident field.
Absolutely.